My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. This week's show is dedicated to Kevin Malik. Our sincere condolences to his wife Jennifer, his family and his friends. Rest in peace, Kevin. Welcome to the final episode of Mysteries and Monsters for 2019. Before we join our final guest this year, which is David Weatherly, I just wanted to thank anyone who supported us, downloaded an episode, or followed us on social media this year. 12 months ago, this all seemed like a million miles away. So to have hit 46 episodes and to see the show keep growing month on month is simply staggering. I, along with my brother Dean, who does all the art, and my social media manager Richard, who looks after the Twitter, the Facebook, the YouTube, and the Instagram especially, could never have imagined we could have reached the number of people we have done this year. We've had almost 50,000 downloads, which is, and it might not seem a lot to some more established podcasts, but for a bloke with a whim, recording this in a room in Sheffield on his own, it's just an incredible number. So thank you to each and every single one of you that may have downloaded an episode, whether you meant to or not. I've been very fortunate to have spoken to some of the most respected people in the world of Fortiana. We've covered UFOs, cryptids, Bigfoot, poltergeists, ABCs, lake monsters, Tasmanian tigers, and even paranormal events witnessed by the police. When we started all this, me and Richard, we had 250 likes on our Facebook group. We're about 50 off 12,000 now, and that's a lot to do with both the show and Richard's hard work. So it's just another incredible statistic in a very humbling year. We've had downloads on every continent in the world with the exception of Antarctica, so perhaps I need to do an episode on The Thing, maybe to rectify that zero in the continent mark. But to be serious, I see countries across the world in the stats, and it just stuns me that people are listening to this show all around the world. So thank you one and all for your continued support, and I can promise you that things are only going to get bigger and better for Mysteries and Monsters in 2020. Especially want to thank Brennan and Ian over at the Ghost Story Guys, Seth Breedlove for always being available whenever he's got a film, and he's very prolific and he still finds time for me. So thank you to Seth and the Small Town Guys. Shannon LeGros, who's the main inspiration for wanting to dip my toe in the world of podcasting. Ryan Sprague, Sam Sheeran, Jonathan Gerlock, Mary Elizabeth Supranant, and Melissa Martell. And finally, along with my family and my partner Julie. Thank you very much, guys. Right, anyway, that's enough of me waffling on. Let's talk about this week's final show. So we're joined by David Weatherly. And David is here to discuss his fantastic book, Eerie Companions, which covers the haunted history of several well-known dolls. We cover all the famous alleged haunted dolls, including my new favourite, Mr. Creepy. So if you haven't heard him, I think you're going to enjoy that story, especially if you're an old romantic like me. And a big thank you to June Nixon over at the Advanced Ghost Hunters of Seattle, Tacoma, for allowing us to use her picture of Mr. Creepy for this week's show art. Thanks, June. Other than that, you know where to find us by now. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram and Twitter as Mystery Monsters. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel. We've got 150, which may not sound a lot, but 10 months ago we had none. So that for us is an incredible achievement. So if you've got a YouTube channel, please join us on there. You can also support us on Patreon for $1 a month. And other than that, thank you again. And here's to 2020. Now it's time to join David Weatherly. We are delighted to welcome back author, investigator and paranormal expert David Weatherly to the show to discuss one of our most requested topics, haunted dolls. David has covered this fascinating subject in his most recent book, Eerie Companions, and we welcome him with a little doll-induced trepidation back to Mysteries and Monsters. David, welcome.
Paul, how you doing, my friend?
I am very well. How's things finding you today?
Fantastic. It's another beautiful day.
Oh, thanks for that. As we fight off the effects of the British winter. But I'm sure you're getting a bit of a tan on my behalf, sir. So thank you for that. Eerie Companions, Haunted Dolls. Primarily over the last sort of 10 years, I would suspect. It's probably one of the aspects of the paranormal that's really come to the fore, David. As someone that's been involved in writing and investigating the paranormal and Fortean subjects, what would you kind of say caused this modern explosion? Or do you think it was a drip effect and then it's just kind of naturally crossed over?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the perfect storm, if you will, because we've had a situation where the paranormal has become more acceptable, if you will, in the past 10 years. And that has sort of dovetailed with people diving into particular aspects of the topic. So, you know, we've had all these, quote, specialists in the last several years who have really spent a lot of time focusing on one particular part of the paranormal as a whole. So, for instance, there are a lot of people who are, for some reason, very, very fascinated with demons and demonology and the whole lore that goes with that. And, of course, along the way, there's been this rise in people who were interested in haunted objects in general, because we do have some pretty crazy and fascinating stories about different objects throughout history that are purportedly cursed or haunted. And when we start looking at that aspect of hauntings and the supernatural, you know, we almost immediately go to dolls, because you bring in another perspective on that. There are a lot of people who have a fear of dolls. It's probably one of the most well-known phobias, and maybe one of the most widespread. And there are a lot of aspects to that phobia, you know, a lot of different things that are grouped under that. But it is a very widespread fear. And beyond the people who have a phobia about dolls, there's also this concept that a lot of people have, or this feeling that a lot of people have, that dolls are creepy in general, even if they don't have a phobia of dolls. You know, I've talked to people who they'll tell you, no, I'm not afraid of dolls, but I do think they're creepy. So, you know, we look at all these different aspects, and I think it's kind of brought us to this sort of culmination. And there's so many different streams that fed into it really over the years. I mean, we could also add in that, you know, dolls have been used for a long time in horror movies to a very good degree, you know, to a great effect. And that, of course, plays into the whole dynamic of how people feel about dolls.
Yeah, very much so. I think, personally speaking, I'm one of those people, David, that has a specific dislike of a certain type of doll, which is ventriloquist's dummies. I've never been keen on them, and I blame it all on watching Magic as a young man.
oh, yes.
Which I still think is one of the creepiest horror films I've seen, especially in the world of weird dolls. But we'll talk about that later, because there's a wonderful chapter in the book covering some of the classic films throughout the years. But it does seem peculiar, as you refer to there, that there are certain aspects of a doll that other people find creepy. Like I say, I'm not saying I'm all right with certain other haunted dolls, but it's the ventriloquist dummy that really puts the shivers up me. I'm not a fan of them, and I know certain people don't like cloth dolls and they don't like porcelain doll. I mean, that's quite unusual in itself, isn't it?
It is, and you know, Paul, I guess we're going to have to talk about Mr. Creepy today, aren't we?
Oh, yes, he's on my list. The lovelorn man, bless him.
So here's the thing, you know, there's the phobia, there's the pedophobia is what all of this stuff is technically grouped under, and it really sort of encompasses a fear of things that replicate living people. So, you know, within that phobia, I mean, there are people who are afraid of very specific types of dolls, whether it's a porcelain doll or whatnot, or talking dolls or ventriloquist dolls. Then there are people who are afraid of mannequins, androids. You know, there's this whole range of this phobia, and it's really something that I think we're going to see play a larger part in society in the coming years, and here's why. There's a concept I delve into in the book called the Uncanny Valley. And the concept of the Uncanny Valley in very short terms is that once something is created to replicate a living being, there's this strange territory it enters, because what happens is, as humans, when we interact with something that is alive, whether it's another person or a child or a baby or, you know, a pet or a squirrel in the park, whatever it is, there are certain dynamics that occur. We see the eye movement. We see some type of body language or responses. If it's a person, we might get verbal responses. And all of these things, they register in a certain part of human consciousness as, quote, acceptable, because, hey, we're interacting with something that's living. Well, Paul, what happens when something is interacting with us, but our logical mind says, this thing is not alive? It should not be doing this. You know, we get this dynamic where, okay, we've got a simple doll that doesn't do anything. Advance that. Now we've got a doll whose eyes open and close and its head turns. Then we've got dolls that talk, that say phrases. Mm-hmm. It's gotten more and more advanced. Mm-hmm. And as it has advanced, people have become more and more unnerved and uncomfortable, a certain number of people. And I think that it's going to be a big thing within our society in the coming years because of the development of robots or androids. If you look now at what scientists in Japan are doing, they are essentially replicating humans. I mean, it's science fiction that, you know, when you and I were kids, you'd look at it on television and say, this is incredible. But we're seeing this. We're seeing this come to life. And, you know, there are synthetic, you know, humans now that will respond to certain comments. They'll have a dialogue with you. Well, what does that do to the human brain? Because, you know, we have to reconcile, how is this happening? This is not a living being. Something is wrong. And for a lot of people, that delves into that territory where all the alarm bells go off, and, you know, there's a great level of discomfort with people trying to reconcile what they're experiencing. And, man, when you throw in the potential or the reality of some dolls being haunted by something otherworldly, that, of course, takes it to a whole different level. And I don't know if I answered your question there, but it kind of led into that quite well. And, you know, I think this is one of the major points of this work that I've done, is trying to get through to people to understand there's a lot more going on here, even on a psychological and emotional level, than just a matter of, hey, here's a doll, it might have a ghost in it.
Yes. Yeah, very true. I think people were obviously used to be terrified about robots and androids adapting their AI, and obviously we saw a famous incident of the Facebook program that after a couple of days decided to create its own language,
Oh, right. Yeah.
and was quickly shut down, or so they tell us anyway. And
Right.
that's something that's always been, it's a mainstay of science fiction through do androids dream of electric sheep to Silent Running and obviously 2000
Terminator.
Terminator
Yes.
2001. These all have the robots sort of reclaiming the Earth because they view humans as a problem rather than a creator. So it's interesting, like you say, that it whereas this kind of developing fear in regards to dolls in their very varied guises seems to cause a more emotional reaction to the people that claim to have had incidents or just generally find them weird.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, obviously the book is firstly a fantastic history of the culture and development of dolls throughout civilization, which I think is quite a strikingly interesting point to the book, David, is that throughout the world, regardless of culture, timescale, wherever, we can trace the use of dolls in a variety of ways across continents and centuries, and I found that very peculiar that certain civilizations seem to develop the doll around the same time for a lot of them, and that's carried on into the modern era.
Yeah, very much so. You see, of course, cultural differences. And, I think that a lot of people don't, unless they're really fascinated by dolls and do the research, a lot of people don't realize some interesting points about dolls. One is that how far back in history they can be traced. They've been found at archaeological sites and just, there's a whole fascinating history, part of the history there. But one of the other things about dolls is that they were not originally made as toys. Most people don't realize this because, in our modern society, when you think of dolls, you think, oh, they're made for little girls to play with. Well, no, originally, probably the most widespread use of dolls originally was for magic and/or ritual. Now, there were some cases where cultures would use dolls as teaching tools and use it to use the dolls or the figures to, act out certain cultural tales and things like that to pass the knowledge on. But what you'll find all over the world is various magical processes using dolls, some type of doll. And of course, the most famous one we have today is the idea of the voodoo doll. But really, it goes, much deeper than that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the most well-known of the interpretation of using a doll as a kind of embodiment of evil or revenge. I think most people, if you ask them, they would, they would all describe the voodoo doll with the sticking of pins in it. So, as a cultural thing, that's probably the most renowned and well-known in the modern era, David, isn't it?
Yeah, it is absolutely. But the use of that type of a doll, first of all, what we're talking about here is essentially what's called sympathetic magic. And it's the principle that if I have something that represents, a person I don't like, I can do things to that representation that will in turn have the same effect on the target. And in very simple terms, that's what we're talking about here. Now, this technique goes very far back in Europe, where they would utilize what's called a poppet, sometimes made of cloth, or they would use sometimes they would use wax figures. There are a whole range of different things that they would utilize as a focal point for their magical ceremony. And usually, just like we hear in voodoo doll stories, what they would do is try to find a personal item, some kind of connection to that target, whether it was a hair clipping or a piece of their clothing, something that would, in effect, energetically tie the victim to the doll itself that was being used in the ritual. So that's how the effect was purportedly carried out on the target. And it's interesting because, you know, voodoo dolls, a lot of people assume, oh, you know, the voodoo doll came from Africa, you know, it's this whole, well, not exactly. The origins of the voodoo doll are pretty gray in a lot of ways. And we have to go back to old New Orleans and look at the melting pot that was, early America. So we had all these influences from the slaves that were brought here during the slavery period. We had European influence from, you know, the French, the Spanish, the English. And there's all of these various traditions just sort of melding together. And somewhere along the way, what essentially is sort of a stylized European poppet began to be used in modern voodoo ritual has, oh, this is a voodoo doll. You know, it's we make it out of cloth and we fill it with their hair and we stick pins in it. So that's kind of the evolution of those. Truthfully, a whole book could be written just on that topic. It's pretty fascinating. But obviously it's covered in the book.
Yeah, very much so. And it's interesting as well, because obviously these days, well, not so much in England, in the British Isles, the term poppet has become to symbolise something that you believe to be cute.
Right.
Which I find a really interesting switch, because that's not what they were 300 years ago.
Well, and at the same time, we have to, I have to put this in. typically, we view that kind of sympathetic magic has all sort of black magic, right? It's for revenge, it's for this or that. Well, a lot of times those types of poppets or dolls would be utilized for what the person viewed as positive things. Love spells were very common. You know, they would try to get someone to fall in love with them by using a poppet. It's still manipulation, so it's still a negative type of expression. But there are other uses of these dolls where, you know, a representation of a person would be made and rituals would be done to try to help them be healthy or have abundance and things like that. So just like in most areas of magic, we find there's a whole range of how these things can be used in ceremony and ritual. And of course, you know, the media immediately latches on to the most sinister and the most dramatic aspects of these things. So hence we get the voodoo doll and, the image of all the pins sticking out of it.
Absolutely, yeah. Many a romantic comedy has often used the purposes of the voodoo doll practice as some kind of plot device often as well.
Yes. David.
It also tells us that apparently it's really easy to pluck hairs out of people, apparently, which I don't think it works like that. But anyway, so, I mean, clearly, I think for most people, there are probably two very famous haunted dolls in the modern era. But I don't want to start with either of those two, if that's all right, because I think I think the wonderful thing about your book is there's a couple of them that I'd never heard of. One we've mentioned briefly earlier, but there's the one whose name I think's the best in the chapter that you do about the famous haunted dolls is Mandy, the cracked-faced doll.
Yes.
Now, that's quite an unusual backstory as well, because it's one of them where it just seems to have appeared with this history of alleged paranormal activity around it.
Yeah, that's true. And have you... I know you've seen the picture, obviously, of
yes,
Mandy.
Yes.
And I just saw Mandy in person last fall.
Mm.
Not this previous fall, but the year before.
Yeah.
It's in a small museum in Quesnel in British Columbia is where the doll ended up. Mm. And, yeah, it's a very strange story. The doll is about 100 years old. To clarify for listeners, The face of this doll is indeed cracked. It's a porcelain doll that has obviously, you know, seen better days. They believe it was made in Europe in the early 1900s. Mm. And the strange thing that happened with this doll is that it was donated to the museum by a woman who chose to remain anonymous. And she marched in, you know, with this antique doll and basically said, I want you to take this doll. And you know, she was acting very peculiar about it. And, you know, obviously considering all the damage and everything, they sort of looked the doll over. And the woman told the people at the museum that since she'd had the doll in her house, she would often wake up with the sound of a child crying in her home. She had no children in her home. Additionally, she would find a window in her basement consistently open. So, you know, the the museum took the doll, and it's one of these things that the stories are kind of muddled. You know, we don't really know. There's a legend that the doll was found in the basement of a house. There's a legend that this is all modern folklore, essentially, that has built up around this doll. Because, you know, we're talking about something that's less than 100 years old.
Yes.
But, you know, people are talking about, well, you know, it was found in the basement of a home. There was a little girl murdered there. There are, you know, all these different things. And in the course of the investigation of this thing, there have been different things that have been captured around Mandy. There have been light anomalies. People claim they've heard voices. People say they've had difficulty taking pictures of her. You know, it was a photographer that came and did a story and had trouble with his equipment. So, you know, some really fascinating things. I mean, when we spent some time around Mandy, we didn't have anything anomalous occur. But it is, you know, I don't have a phobia of dolls, but this is an odd looking doll just because of the damage and everything. And it's sort of, you look at it and it's sort of the eyes are kind of half shut. It's sort of a sleepy looking doll almost. And it just, it has this atmosphere that, oh, this doll's kind of creepy.
Is Mandy one of the dolls where you kind of have to seek acceptance before you can sort of approach or talk to her or take a picture, David?
Well, there's no specific legends of that, no. And, you know, it seems to be, this is one of the dolls that seems to be very, I would say, inconsistent with what manifests around it. You know, sometimes there are things going on, sometimes there's activity, sometimes there's not. Curiously enough, the museum that the doll is in does have some other areas of activity. And I've spoken to a number of people who have been able to investigate that museum, and they do report there are strange things that occur just, you know, in the building itself. And they've, I do know a couple of people that have had some serious things occur with Mandy. One person that got very, very ill just from being close to her. So, you know, I think some of these dolls, I would say that some people are more susceptible to these hauntings than others at times. And I think that's one of the factors that comes in when we consider these objects.
Yeah, because some of them really do tend to, for some of the, I use the term victims, but I'm not really sure that's, I think that's overcooking it somewhat. but some of the people who have met a variety of these famous dolls do seem to have a real kind of, you know, obviously there are many mentions of people suffering physical ailments from a visit where they may have been disrespectful. But there also seems to be a lot of psychological trauma for people who perhaps may not be strong enough to deal with whatever these embodiments are emitting.
Sure, that's definitely an aspect, and that goes back to what we talked about earlier. You know, this concept of the uncanny valley, the phobias, of course, that affect a lot of people, and how they respond in the presence of these things.
Yeah, very much so, because it's essentially a two-pronged attack for some of these dolls when they meet certain people. I have to touch on my favourite doll in your book. And to be honest, because it's quite a sad story. If you read this in a romantic novel, you'd probably have it tugging at your heartstrings, which is the delightfully named Mr. Creepy.
Oh yes.
And I found after rereading your book, David, I've got a lot of respect for Mr. Creepy. I'm kind of rooting for him that he's reunited.
Yeah. So Mr. Creepy is he's one of your favorites, Paul. He's a ventriloquist doll.
Yeah, precisely, which is what has caused me a bit of conflict over this particular situation. But yeah, I'm comfortable with moving on.
So here's the Mr. Creepy. It is a fascinating story, and it is a sad story. Mr. Creepy is he's owned by a good friend of mine who lives in Seattle, Ross Allison. And Ross discovered Mr. Creepy because, much like I do, Ross will he travels a lot, and he'll often go into antique stores, and he kind of does something similar to me. He'll start talking to the people and say, "Do you have anything in here that's, you know, unusual or strange, or, you know, maybe maybe bothers you?" And of course he had this incident where he walked into one of these shops and was talking to the clerk, and the immediate response was, "Mr. Creepy." And Ross, of course, was intrigued by the comment, just as I would have been. And he said, "What's, you know?" So this person took him over and showed him a glass case with this ventriloquist doll. And Ross was told this ventriloquist doll moves all over the place, and, you know, really disturbs me. And of course, Ross purchased the doll. If you go online, of course, there are photographs in my book. You can find pictures online too of Mr. Creepy. In some ways, he's kind of comical because you look at him and he's a ventriloquist doll who has a big mop of hair and sort of a big, shall I say, a big 70s porn stash, as they used to call it. You know? And the wide eyes, you know, that a lot of ventriloquist dolls have. However, the background story to this doll is this. There was a gentleman who was a professional ventriloquist and performed for many, many years. He was very talented. And he was also a talented carver and made ventriloquist dolls himself. So in his later years, he made a doll in his likeness. This is Mr. Creepy. Now, he went a couple of steps further because in deciding to make the doll in his likeness, he decided, well, what would make this even better but to use some of my own hair? So it is his human hair that he utilized to make the ventriloquist doll in his likeness. Around the time he did this, he made a second doll, one in the likeness of his lifelong love, his wife, that also was made utilizing her hair. The story is that, you know, somehow these dolls ended up probably sold at an estate sale or something and ended up with this antique shop. The two dolls were together on display for a long time, and something happened. I can't recall right off. Something happened that the antique shop had to move their location. And when they did so, of course, they packed everything up and just massive amounts of product and antiques that they put in storage until they secured their new location and opened back up. And when they opened back up and started putting things out, they found Mr. Creepy, but they did not find Mrs. Creepy. So from that time forward, this doll would move on its own. People have come in and found it. It's on display at Ross's Spooked in Seattle. He runs a ghost tour, and he also has a museum area that you can go in. And you can see Mr. Creepy, who sits in a glass case. And both Ross and people that work at Spooked have had some strange incidents around this figure. Ross caught a very amazing photograph of the doll sort of leaning against the glass, and there's a reflection, you know, that is from somewhere else of what looks like another face, another Mr. Creepy type of face. And the belief is that the doll is looking for its companion. So, you know, they'll come in and find its head turned in different directions, to be found leaning against the glass, you know, when there's really no reason that it should have moved. Nothing else in the case has moved. And, you know, it's something that there's been a lot of activity around this doll. And, you know, I keep telling Ross he should maybe put an ad out that said, you know, Mr. Creepy seeks Mrs. Creepy to see if anyone is. But he's concerned, you know, that he would get the wrong kind of responses. Maybe that's a concern. I don't know. But
very true.
But,
very
you
true.
Know, it's yeah, so it's a fascinating story. It's kind of a sad story. And I think, like you, I think we're all rooting for at some point Mrs. Creepy turning up.
I mean, we might all be pulling for the wrong thing, and getting them together could be the worst thing for everybody, David. But
it could create chaos like the end of Ghostbusters. We just don't.
Very true, but I'm an old soft romantic at heart, and it's very odd. There's a real emotional response to this story, I think, when you read it, especially because you discover that, you know, this was the representation of a loving couple. With the addition of them using their own hair for these dolls, which kind of then once again connects us back to that kind of love potion spell, and using hair to kind of bind a spell or a spirit to an object. So there's clearly a bit of old fashioned superstition attached to perhaps the reason they created them in the first place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, as you're stating, we get this story in particular is fascinating because we do get all these conflicting elements. You know, for people who are unnerved or disturbed by dolls, he'll do it. You know, you just take a look at him. And then, of course, he's a ventriloquist doll, so you have the moving, the moving features. And, you know, then there's sort of the old kind of 70s style look that he has, which is sometimes comical and sometimes for other people a bit unsettling in and of itself. And then, you know, it's interesting to see people meeting Mr. Creepy for the first time. And when you throw the fact on them that, oh, by the way, this is human hair, responses that, you know, I've seen people just sort of turn pale and have a hard time wrapping their minds around that fact. But yeah, that's yet another element. And as you stated, it creates this sort of energetic binding to, you know, someone that is long past, but maybe in some way is still here.
Yeah, absolutely. As if they could carry on their love from the other side, I suspect, David.
Absolutely.
Oh, and good on. Let's make that our big paranormal drive for next year, 2020. Let's get the creepies back together, I think. We could all pull together in the 40-in field, David, and see what happens.
Hey, you never know. You never know if enough people are out there looking.
Well, I mean, as you touch on, haunted dolls have also essentially become big business, haven't they? And there's a very interesting story. I'm trying to be balanced about it, because having read your book, I think I know which side of the fence I fall on in this one. And that's the story of Harold the doll, who seems to be one of these that's turned up with a backstory and been sold.
Yeah, Harold is fascinating just because it's I'm just trying to think where to start with Harold. So Harold initially surfaced has a quote haunted doll, and got a lot of attention, if you will. He was featured on an episode of Ghost Adventures. He was, you know, pretty notorious for a time there, and you know, purportedly was a very dangerous doll that was causing deaths. And then the other shoe kind of dropped, and it was revealed that the original story was fabricated. But, you know, this is one of those things, Paul. Harold really fascinates me because...
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
It's sort of watching folklore come to life in front of our eyes, and to a degree. And, you know, it also kind of reels in the concept that how much do we as humans create or co-create these hauntings? Because the story with Harold is that, you know, all of these events transpired. Then this monkey wrench is thrown in when someone says, oh, by the way, this is all. That was fabricated. That didn't happen. But then you've got documented incidents around this doll that do continue to occur. And it seems as if, we're left with this strange puzzle where we have to say, okay, either Harold was always haunted, even though part of the story was fabricated, mm-hmm. or Harold was not initially haunted, but because so many people believe that he is now.
Yep.
So it's quite a fascinating story. The man who owns him now, Anthony Quinata, is, has documented, he's written a whole book on Harold and documents a lot of the stuff that transpired with the doll and still does. And Anthony says, that there's so many things that he's documented, and I've talked to other people who have documented very strange events around this doll. So it does seem that something is occurring around this doll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harold doesn't seem to be very keen on psychics either, does he?
No.
I think out of all the dolls, he's the one probably with the pottiest mouth, I would suspect.
It seems so, yeah.
he seems to take real umbrage, if we are to believe, but it's more than one person that's claimed this in these kind of interactions with Harold at the invitation of his current owner. That they all seem to have had very negative and personal experiences with it when they've sort of tried to probe it.
Yeah, and there's other people, that have simply tried to investigate Harold because, these legends of people, dire illnesses and death and so forth around this doll. But there are other people that have just investigated or been around the doll and have come away with ill effects. So, again, we have to consider, is that, what exactly is going on there? Is that something psychological? What's the dynamic that's occurring? It would be, Harold's one of those things it would be really curious to me to sort of do some experiments with. And, for instance, introducing someone to him who had no idea who he was, or anything about the background story, so there's not that, so they're not predisposed to, oh, this is a very sinister doll. And what does it put off? I'd kind of like to see that done, just to see how those people respond and if there are effects, that people independently experience without knowing the background story.
Absolutely. I think with anything, when it comes to the paranormal and Fortean, David, we should always try to achieve a litmus test with, either complete skeptics or people who have no idea about the phenomenon that you want them to kind of give you a gauge on. And I think it can be sometimes interesting, as you say there, has Harold's reputation manifested itself due to the modern interpretation of his original story, or is it like you say, was he always a nasty piece of work according to these people, and it just wasn't picked up properly?
Well, sure. And then we could almost bring this full circle, Paul, and say, well, there's the age-old idea that you can imbue a doll with energy, just like you would do in a ceremony or a magical ritual. So, what has happened now over the years that people have met Harold or even just looked at pictures of him and thought about him and thought about, that's an evil doll. You know, because we really basically we only have a basic knowledge of the human energy field at this point. There's so much more we need to learn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ancient cultures, ancient traditions have long talked about what humans are capable of, you know, on an energetic level. And I know for some people that sounds like I'm getting into, oh, he's getting all new age or, you know, mm-hmm. No, this is, we're talking about very simple concepts. You know, the quantum sciences are looking at these things. You know, scientists in the last 10 to 15 years are looking more and more at the human energy field and saying, what is it? You know, what are we able to project? Mm-hmm. And if you start considering that, in terms of some of these objects, well, what have we, like I said earlier, what have we co-created?
Mm. I think it's one of those things as well that throughout folklore and mythology, David, there's always been an innate belief in the ability to give life to inanimate objects, be it from the Jewish faith with the golem, you know, Greek mythology bringing the dead back to life, same in Roman, Egyptian. There's always been that kind of control over imbibing life of something that shouldn't be there, either for good or nefarious reasons, David.
Oh, absolutely. And that those concepts can be found all over the world. And I mean, really, you know, we could, I mean, this is off topic for today, but we could really even go down the other route and talk about the concept of tulpas. Which is something I've delved into quite extensively. And, you know, that is essentially creating something from just a bare thought.
Yes.
And it goes through a whole evolution. But I think that, you know, within the spectrum of the paranormal, one of the things that is often not considered is the human factor, the human interaction. You know, what is occurring? You know, what's occurring when one person goes in to investigate a purportedly haunted location? What's occurring when five people or 10 people go in together? Each thing changes the dynamic, because you have to consider each of those individuals, how they interact with each other, how they respond to each other, to the environment, and so on and so forth. It's very complex, and it's something that is not often paid much attention to, because, you know, people sort of go in and, you know, they have a very set mind, you know, that, oh, I'm going to go in and I'm going to check EMF readings or, you know, get EVPs or whatever. And, you know, I always say, let's look at this very holistically and understand exactly what dynamics are going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think it spreads out into wider portions as well, David, because obviously you've got, you know, probably the most common experience for people of that is your gut feeling, and gut feelings make no sense at all scientifically, because why do you get that feeling in your stomach? It doesn't seem to have any kind of rational response.
Right, and we could consider that an energetic response on some level, because And I use that term because we're responding to something that we don't consciously understand what's causing this reaction. And so many people use that. You know, Paul, there's the whole in America, there's a whole concept of what's called the blue sense. And this is a phrase that's used by law enforcement. And I've had a lot of friends in law enforcement over the years, and, you know, an amazing number of law enforcement officers have incredible stories. You know, it's not always consistent, but there are these moments when they have this extrasensory experience, you know, where they just know there's something that they can't quite define that tells them, no, I can't go through this door. No, I need to go in this direction. You know, something that occurs that seems extraordinary in the aftermath, but in the moment they follow that gut feeling, as you call it, and it works out for the best.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is it? What's causing that react? You know, where do they get that information from?
Yeah, it's almost as if the environment seems to be charged differently. I think if you speak to anybody, coincidentally, David, who's worked in the entertainment industry or you know, working as a waiter or a waitress or a bartender or even a bouncer, they will all tell you, and I speak from previous experience of my younger years, there are certain occasions when you can just feel that it's going to be one of those nights. There's something about it that it just doesn't feel right. Do you know what I mean? It's as though things are slightly out of kilter.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, very much so. Well, I think that's a good way to kind of point us towards our two most notorious dolls. one of whom I think really does deserve his own film, but I suspect people don't want... It may be a subject nobody wants to touch. So I'll start with the one that's made the transfer to the cinema, which is obviously the infamous Annabelle. But Annabelle's quite striking because the cinema version bears no resemblance to the real one.
No, there's not. Not at all. And it's funny, you know, of course, the Annabelle films have been wildly, wildly successful. There are people who don't even realize that, you know, the story came from a quote, paranormal case. But Annabelle, the original doll, is a Raggedy Ann doll. Now, to some degree, I can kind of understand the filmmakers because, you know, I think if you were going to pick any kind of doll that looks non-threatening, it's probably the Raggedy Ann doll. You know, this is just basically a floppy, you know, cloth doll with a smile and bright, you know, stringy hair. And of course, what they did in the film was they went the route of the sort of classical porcelain looking doll. You know, that's unsettling for a lot of people. But the original doll was, the story came from a case investigated by Ed and Lorraine Warren. Now, the Warrens are pretty well known, obviously. They're the basis of the Conjuring franchise that's been coming out. And, you know, they were some of the modern era's, you know, first celebrity ghost hunters, if you will. I guess is probably the way to talk about them. They started investigating cases very actively in the 70s. I can remember when I was a kid, you know, I saw the Warrens lecture early on. They were kind of making a name for themselves even back then, and were traveling about. Ed's approach was very Catholic-based, delved into the demonology aspects. Lorraine, who we lost this year, she was a psychic and would do readings on the cases. And the story about Annabelle is that they got a call from a young woman who had this doll, and it was creating all these problems in her apartment. She said that the doll had it was moving around on its own, was, you know, reportedly attacking people, just really kind of creeping everyone out. And they would find notes that had been written purportedly by Annabelle on these pieces of parchment, which further disturbed them, of course. So finally, they end up with Ed and Lorraine coming and taking the doll away. And even when the Warrens take the doll away, you know, there's an incident where they're driving away with the doll in the back seat, and Ed almost loses control of the car. So all these stories that surround this doll, it ended up in the Warrens Museum. It was a very famous picture. It's easy to find online of this case that was built to house this doll with a, you know, warning sign, and do not open, and a little glass window to look in at this Raggedy Ann doll. And it's sort of it's strange and sort of absurd in some ways. And then you hear the backstory and you hear that, you know, this doll is considered highly dangerous by these veteran investigators. It's currently, it's still, it's under the care of Tony Sparrow.
Yep.
and who inherited the doll itself. And of course, it's become a household name due to the movies of recent years. And it's probably might be the most famous haunted doll currently. Yeah. You know, everybody knows who Annabelle is at this point.
Absolutely. I mean, was Tony the Warren's son-in-law?
Yes.
Yeah, because I think that's, yeah. Now, obviously, I think not along with the films is it, you touch on this incident, because when I decided to sort of return to the 14th subject, this incident happened towards the back end of 2017, I think, where Annabelle famously appeared on Ghost Adventures. Or rather, yes. Infamously, due to what occurred. Now, what's your feelings about that, David? Because that seems to be a no-win situation for everybody involved in it, I think.
Yeah. So, the story is, of course, Annabelle, who rarely is taken out of the secure case, Tony agreed to bring Annabelle to take Annabelle to Las Vegas, Nevada, for an episode of Ghost Adventures, and he carried the doll to Zach's museum in Vegas, where an investigation was done that included Annabelle, and it was kind of dramatic as it unfolded, because during the course of the investigation, Tony had set down some very strong parameters. And one of the things was he insisted that no one touch the doll. He carried in this very specially designed box, and he would only take it out with gloves himself and, you know, put it up where it was going to be investigated. And during the course of the investigation, Zach touched the doll, which upset Tony greatly, mm-hmm. and caused him to take the doll and leave the museum.
Yep.
So those two have kind of, you know, they reconciled the situation. I don't think that, I won't speak to their personal opinions on it. I have spoken to Zach about the situation when I was working on the book. And, there were some strange things that manifested around the doll during the course of the investigation. They were using an SLS camera, which is the Kinect camera that detects the stick figures, you know, when something is trying to manifest. They had readings from that. They had numerous other manifestations occurring. And, you know, all of those guys say, no, there's something about that doll. It's something very unsettling. There's something, you know, disturbing. There's something attached to it. This is what these guys believe. And once again, you know, we have a situation similar to Harold where we just don't really know. I mean, it's hard to go back now, and obviously we can't go back and reinvestigate the original incident because, you know, that's long past. It's hard to find the origins. You know, where did Annabelle come from exactly? Was there something that occurred prior to the young woman who received her? And, you know, all we have to go on is, at this point, decades of people believing that this is a highly charged, evil doll. Mm-hmm. And that alone, perhaps, has charged the object enough so that it is indeed something troublesome.
Yeah. I think there seems to be a consistent thing with this, David, that for a lot of these dolls, it's very hard to unpick fact from fiction, especially over the last sort of 20 years, as these items have become more popular and more discussed. Would you say that's more of a frustration than anything? Because we tend to lose some of these origin stories are quite nondescript, really. Obviously, I know Mr. Creepy's is quite a strange but nice story. Whereas, like you say, Annabelle's story seems to be, is it fact or is it myth now?
Right. Right. Or is it both?
Yeah.
You know, you know, again, what are we seeing? What kind of story are we seeing be created? It is kind of frustrating. It's also, for me, you know, it's understandable to a degree because we're talking about some of these dolls, you know, under a lot of circumstances, it would be very difficult to trace their their origins and to define, you know, to understand exactly why is this thing, you know, why are strange things happening around this doll? I know that I've seen a lot. I've seen an awful lot of haunted dolls, and they surface constantly. Of course, there's a whole market now for these haunted dolls. You go on eBay and you type that in, you'll get so many results. It's mind-boggling. And really, how do you trace down? You know, how do you vet those stories? Well, it's a fascinating story, but you know, where did it come from originally? It's kind of difficult. I mean, you know, Paul, you could walk into a thrift store and probably buy half a dozen creepy dolls. Mm. And for all intent and purposes, that moment of you purchasing that thing and having some kind of experience, that's the starting point of the story, because who knows where it came from before that. Mm-hmm. You know, it could have been, you know, it could have been some little girl's play toy for 20 years, or likewise, it could have been something that was being used in, you know, in San Francisco in satanic rituals. I mean, we just, you know, we really don't know. So it creates this hazy area of history around some of these objects that in some ways make them frustrating and in other ways make them all the more intriguing. Mm.
And I think a prime example of that is probably the last celebrity doll I want to touch on, David. Which is Robert, who is, out of all the dolls, seems to be the most sensible because he's moved to Florida. So clearly Robert likes the good weather most of the year, so fair play to him. And also, the obviously his attire would tend to put him, you know, he had to be on a coastal state at the very least, David. So, but Robert's one of those stories where there's the myth and... But we've actually been able to unpick it and find the kernel of truth about his origins and what happened there.
Yeah, Robert is probably my favorite. I call him the grandfather of haunted dolls because really he's the guy. he's the one. Robert the doll. You made a comment earlier about movies based on Robert, and actually, a lot of people don't realize this, but there have been a couple of movies made about Robert specifically. They were very low budget, not very well done, unfortunately. But the word is that he was also the inspiration for probably the other most famous movie doll, and that is Chucky. So, you know, we have those things to kind of throw into the Robert story. But the tale of Robert, originally, I remember hearing this when I was very young and interested in these things. The original story that passed around for years was that Robert the doll was handmade by a servant woman who worked in the Otto household. Who, depending on the version you listen to, she was either fired or she became angered by something that had transpired and she decided to curse the family. So using some form of voodoo, she made this doll and gave it a certain degree of life and gave it as a, quote, gift to the little boy in the family, Robert Eugene Otto. Hmm. And after that, all kinds of chaos and trouble broke out in the household. So over the years, you know, people dug into the story and it turned out that the whole thing about the voodoo curse and the magic used on the doll and so forth was all folklore. And it still stands as part of the whole tapestry that makes up the Robert story. But we know that, no, this is not the case. In fact, there's a gentleman in Key West where Robert lives currently named David Sloan, who has done a lot of work on Robert and his origins, and they eventually traced down. They were able to find some of the original origins of Robert. It turned out that he came from Europe, and that he was made as a doll for a display window. So it sort of gave him some unique aspects. It's believed that the clothing he wears, which is a sailor's suit, was probably clothing that belonged to Eugene Otto, the little boy who had the doll. And that he gave Robert his own clothes. Now, for those who don't know the story of Robert, he was indeed given to this little boy. The little boy's name was Robert Eugene Otto. And when he received this doll, he dubbed the doll Robert. He gave Robert his own name. And from that point forward, the little boy wasn't called Robert anymore. The little boy was called Eugene. And the doll was called Robert. And indeed, strange things did begin to occur in the Eugene household, or in the Otto household. So these things would happen that, you know, at a base level, it sounds like, oh, this has got to be a kid up to some mischief. So, you know, plates would be thrown on the floor and smashed. And when the parents rushed in, Eugene would say, Robert did it. Wasn't me. Robert did it. Mm-hmm. Other things, other incidents began to occur. And consistently, the little boy would say, Robert did it. Now, if this is not unusual enough, has Eugene got older, as everyone does, he went to school, he went away to Europe, and he left all his things in the Otto household, including Robert. And Eugene ended up, he got married, and when his, I believe it was his mother that became ill, Eugene and his new wife moved back to Key West, back into the Otto household to help take care of his mother, who obviously she eventually passed away in fairly short order, actually. And Eugene and his new wife continued on in the Otto household in Key West. Now, it all sounds fine on the surface, but the odd thing is that when they moved back to Key West, Eugene took up his old friendship with Robert the doll. He gave Robert his own room upstairs in the attic. He had furniture built for Robert that was just his size. And Robert would frequently sit in a rocking chair in front of the window looking down on the street. Now, other stories begin to grow up around this time because school kids passing by that window, go figure, they got really creeped out because they said that every time they walked by going or coming from school, there'd be this doll in the window staring down at them. And it just proved to be unnerving. A lot of the kids said that the doll would be standing at the window watching them. So much so that a lot of these kids, would you believe, they began to take a different route back and forth to school just so they didn't have to walk by the household and have the creepy doll watching them. But then other people reported strange things. They reported hearing little footsteps running around upstairs when they were visiting in the Otto household. Different sounds would come from the home that just didn't seem to make any sense because there was no one else there. Eventually, after Eugene passed away, his wife, I think, couldn't get rid of the doll fast enough. the doll ended up being donated to a museum. And I'm giving you the short version of the Robert story because there's much more to it. But essentially, Robert ended up in the care of the Fort East Martello Museum in Key West. And he's in a display case, glass display case there in the museum. And there's other legends that grew up about around Robert. One is that you better respect Robert or he'll curse you. Part of that respect is that you should act nice when you're around him, not make fun of him or make jokes. And that if you want to take his picture, you better ask permission first. Hmm. Or things may get very bad for you. Now, we can look at this and say, oh, okay, well, this is more crazy folklore. However, if you go and visit Robert at the museum, you'll see a display there behind him of a large board covered with letters. Now, these letters are changed out on occasion because, you see, the museum constantly receives letters from people who have come to the museum. They saw Robert, and they made the mistake of making fun of him, making jokes, or taking his picture without asking permission. And in the aftermath, they experienced terrible misfortunes. These letters, they're addressed to Robert. And they say things like, Dear Robert, please forgive me for making fun of you. I'm so sorry. Can you please remove the curse? These letters will tell the tales of making fun of Robert leaving the museum, getting in a car accident, or suddenly losing their job, or losing their wallet, losing their airplane tickets, having their boyfriend suddenly leave them. The list goes on and on and on of people who have experienced misfortunes just because they made fun of Robert the doll.
He's quite weird as well in regards to, because...
Be careful, Paul!
Oh, I don't mean he. Essentially, the story is... Yeah, thanks, David. Yeah, and I'll sleep well tonight. Brilliant. So, is the fact that his life story is extremely odd, to say the least, because there's clearly some deep-seated psychological situation there that caused Eugene to essentially create a best friend for him as a child, and then to rekindle that relationship on returning home as an adult is extremely unusual.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and it's, you know, all of the psychological aspects aside, I mean, you're talking a long period now, because it was the early 1900s, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we've got a doll with a very long history at this point. And again, a lot of years, a lot of stories. And you throw in just a few of the other aspects, like the strange psychology that it did take for, you know, Eugene to develop this relationship. It really is a relationship that he developed with the doll. And in his mind, clearly, this was a living, sentient being.
Yeah. I think the thing that made me laugh most about people's responses to Robert is the fact that he gets gifts sent to him, including including a lot of joints, which I found a very weird take on Robert's mythos, that people seem to think that what that doll needs is to get stoned.
Yeah.
And I do like the disclaimer that you say the staff don't help themselves to any of his treats.
Right. Yeah, it may, you know, maybe it's just maybe it's people hoping that he'll calm down and uncurse them or something, you know, after hearing the stories. But yeah, it's candy and joints are two of the biggest things that are sent to him for some reason. But there's, you know, it's funny. There's another story about Robert, and I'll throw this one in there too. There's an incident that occurred at this museum wherein one night, everything closed down, the staff closed the museum up. And the next day when they came in to open, they were doing their rounds, and they discovered that Robert was not alone in his case. In the case with him, sitting on his lap, was a small stuffed lion. And they were initially quite mystified at this, trying to figure out, you know, how did this occur during hours the museum was closed? They eventually discovered that the stuffed animal had come from another display in the museum. And of course, the implication is that Robert had had enough of being alone in that case and went to get himself a friend or a little pet or whatever. So sometime during the night, somehow this animal, the stuffed animal, ended up in the case with Robert. And the staff all pretty much unanimously said, "I'm not taking it out."
Yeah.
He wants it. He can keep it. So to this day, you see him. He still has that stuffed lion with him.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of these doll stories, David, that you cover where they all see. Some of them seem to be quite annoyed about being alone. And I think Robert, bless him. I mean, how long has he been in this case?
Oh, gosh. You know, I can't remember off the top of my head what year they... He's been in the museum quite a few years at this point.
Yeah, no wonder he wants some company. I don't blame him, David. Nobody likes being in solitary confinement, whether you're a person or a doll. So, well, if that's what makes him happy, then good luck to them both, I think.
There you go.
So the last aspect of this I'll touch on, David, before we cover your upcoming 2020 and what you've got planned, is there's a brilliant chapter all about creepy dolls in films, and obviously we've mentioned a couple of them, Chucky being probably one of the most famous, but you mention a couple of my favorite films. One is one of those films that I don't think anybody else has seen, but clearly I think you had, which is Devil Doll, which is the very weird story about a ventriloquist and his special doll Hugo.
Oh yes. Ugh. Yes, that's from that's an old film. That's from 1964, I want to say.
Yeah, I think so. It's mid-60s, yeah. I think, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, I'm sure you quite enjoyed it because of it. It's a ventriloquist doll, as you said.
Yeah, look, thankfully I saw that after I'd seen Magic. So, and he's really creepy as well, because essentially it's a man in a really odd costume, which makes it look even weirder.
Yeah, you know, given the time period it was made, you know, the effects weren't quite the same. So, you know, we did have this very, you know, the effects are very bizarre, and it's been a couple of years since I watched that movie, but it is kind of still unsettling, you know, and it does have those elements. I mean, just like Magic that you mentioned earlier, I mean, I remember seeing Magic back, you know, that one came out in the 70s.
Yeah.
And that one, even today, I think still stands up quite well, just because it's such a strange psychological thriller, you know, with the use of this ventriloquist doll. And I won't give away the plot lines for people who want to see these, you know, because they really are just amazing pieces to watch. And of course, you know, one of the ones prior to that wasn't a film, but an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
With Telly Savalas.
Yes.
And, you know, my name is Talky Tina, and I don't like you.
Yeah.
that's a really creepy depiction of here's a doll that decides it doesn't like someone, and is going to do whatever it can to get at this person. And it's, again, a lot of the Twilight Zone episodes, they stand up quite well to time. And I think that one does too, you know, as well.
Absolutely. It's always been one of my favorite episodes, along with the legendary William Shatner Terror at 30,000 Feet episode with the monster on the wing. Goodness me, that still frightens me as a grown man.
Yeah.
Never, that the way he's looking through, oh, and he's going mad. Brilliant. One of my favorite ever Twilight Zones. That's amazing. And obviously it's Shatner. It's brilliant. But
right.
I mean, the other one that I've always found very interesting, because it kind of crosses two paranormal genres, especially both of them have come to the fore, as we say about dolls, David, which is the clown doll in Poltergeist.
Oh, yes.
Because that seems to be a merge of two real fears. You know, if you've got pedophobia and coulrophobia, you're in big trouble when you come to Poltergeist, because there's no preparing yourself, because you know what's coming.
Yeah.
I remember I think I was 10 when I saw Poltergeist, and it's the first film, scary film I watched in the daytime that still frightened me.
It's interesting, you know, I'm asked about clowns all the time, and I don't really cover them in the book. Now, you know, there's a few mentions, and of course, you know, clown dolls do come in some cases. Curiously, there's not really a famous haunted clown doll that has surfaced and gotten a lot of attention. I mean, there are some here and there. But, you know, you also branch over to this whole other phobia, people who have this fear of clowns. And, you know, we have the whole, you know, all the weird business with people dressing as clowns just to terrify people or just to stand and get their picture caught on Google Earth or whatever, you know. It's very bizarre. And, you know, that whole world, the topic does fascinate me, because I'm actually more interested in the early origins and folklore of clowns, which of course have a lot to do with social commentary and everything else. And I think that it's sort of sad that they have been pitched in as such an object of fear in recent years. I think we're losing something on a social level, if that makes sense to you, Paul. Without expounding on that, you know, extensively, you know, we have to recall that the clown or the trickster figure goes far, far back in history and was always, I think, a vital component of a healthy society because of its outlet to express things. And, you know, we can say to a certain degree that, well, we still sort of have it. We have stand-up comedians and they make social commentary and so forth. But even that, to a degree, is sort of in trouble. I don't want to sidetrack too much, but, you know, I just saw a story recently where a comedian in Canada has been fined, I think it's $35,000 for making a joke about, and I forget, I think it was a joke about a disabled person or something. Yeah. So, you know, without getting into political commentary, we have to consider, you know, where are we going with all of this and how are we viewing the outlets in our society for these expressions? And clowns certainly come into that spectrum.
Absolutely. I think that's a very interesting point, because it's as almost as though, I mean, I've noticed it, especially over the last few years, a couple of years ago when every country in the world seemed to be having a flap of killer clowns running everywhere, even though, as far as I'm aware of, nobody had actually been killed by any of these clowns. They just became killer clowns.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a strange leap of faith, if anything. But it's one of those things where, once again, I think people aren't sure where the change came, because I know a lot of people tend to say it's because of John Wayne Gacy, and obviously the notoriety of the fact that he was a children's entertainer. He often dressed as a clown. However, he was also an horrific serial killer and preyed on young boys. But then a lot of other people would say, well, no, it's when Poltergeist came. But I think it's something that horror films have kind of, I mean, they've tended to do it to a lot of, you know, we've got evil Santas and we've got, you know, all kinds of loving things that become serial killers in all horror films, you know. And it's weird that clowns seem to have suffered the most negatively from that kind of horror endorsement, if that makes sense, David.
Yeah, well, and you've got some really strong pieces out there, like you mentioned, Poltergeist. Of course, we have Stephen King's It.
Yes.
And, you know, both the original depiction of that in films and then the recent remake of that, which, you know, it all reinforces this idea. And then we've got, you know, just I think multiple streams that have sort of fed into that. We've got the whole Gacy thing, who, you know, Gacy wasn't a trained clown. And if you look at particular aspects of what he was doing, for instance, on a very simple level, you know, clown school, they teach everything needs to be rounded, you know, all the face paint and everything should be rounded so it's not scary, or, you know, they have very defined ways that they make themselves comical and, you know, comforting is what they're going for. But, you know, Gacy did the opposite. You look at pictures of Gacy dressed as a clown. Yeah. His smile is very pointed and sharp. Yeah. And you know, then we get into the whole other media aspects that throw that in, because we've got the Joker, who is a clown.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's went from originally in the comic books being just kind of ridiculous and absurd. And again, a certain degree, I think, of social commentary, of you know, just weirdness, to being this very sinister, dark killer who just, you know, slaughters wholesale. Yeah. So, you know, we're a far cry from, who was it, the Cesar Romero, who did this, yes, this Batman thing in the 60s, you know, and just was this ridiculous clown, you know, Joker, and to what we've got today, where it's, you know, you see depictions where the smile is almost cut into his face and things. So
yeah, especially when you think about, because obviously a lot of people will tell you that the Joker that Bob Kane created was based on the Conrad Veidt film. Is it The Man That Couldn't Smile?
Yes, that's correct.
Which is a remarkable film when you look. I think it was made in the late 20s, because I think it's a silent film, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And essentially, that's that typical horror love story. It's very similar to The Hunchback of Notre Dame, where some kind of afflicted person tries to find love despite the ridicule of society around them. Which, when you look at his origins to what he's become, he's kind of nothing. He bears no resemblance to his original incarnation at all.
No, not at all.
Remarkable. I mean, lastly, I'll mention the fact I'm always delighted to see anybody mention Puppet Master, because I think they're some of the most underrated horror films. Puppet Master 3 is my favourite. It makes no sense. And recently, because it's wonderful. It's puppets versus the Nazis. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's great.
Toulon's Revenge, I think it's called. If you've never seen it, I recommend it highly for a 2-hour laugh. And that's recently had a new film come out, which is strangely looks like they lost the script halfway through it.
I haven't seen the newer one.
it's worth a watch, but I'll tell you, halfway through you think, hang on a minute, what on earth has just happened? It's one of those films where something happens and you're like, whoa, where are we going
there? But you're right. Yes, you're right. You can't get much better than a bunch of, you know, possessed puppets killing the Nazis. So
yeah, they've all got wonderful little talents as well.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Marvelous. So, 2020, David, on the horizon. Sounds like it's possibly going to be another busy year for you. So, first, what's next for you coming out?
Oh, gosh, let's see. Two books coming up. The long-awaited Wood Knots 4. I know I've had a lot of people message me about that. Cover's been up for a while, and it's finally being put together. Those really are a lot of work, you know, a lot of different contributors, and we want to make it an excellent edition each time we do another volume of those. So number 4 is coming out early in 2020. Mm-hmm. And right before that, probably – right after the first of the year, will be the next installment in my State Cryptids series. And this one is Monsters of the Last Frontier. I'm covering the cryptids and legends of Alaska. And that one was kind of challenging, just because I've been to Alaska a lot and had a lot of material from there, but there's so much. There's so much that occurs in that state. And I really had to sort of refine that and you know, cover some of these topics that for some people are quite confusing. The cover I released today, it's another beautiful piece by artist Sam Sharon. Yep. And he has depicted the Kushtaka, which in Alaskan lore roughly translates as the otter men or the otter people. And Sam is amazing, and throwing this one at him, I just wasn't sure, you know, because I've seen a few people try to do artistic depictions of these things, and it just doesn't come out very well. But man, he pulled this off, and it's another gorgeous wraparound cover that shows some of the other legends that are covered. You get a glimpse of a lake monster, and there's a mammoth in the background, because there are legends of mammoths that lived much longer than people believe. Yeah. And some other things. So yeah, that's that one's coming out in should be out in less than a month now.
Fantastic. So early January.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, it is very interesting, David, as you touched on there about mammoths. It's probably as Fortean subjects go, one of those outside of Russia I've never really stumbled across. And then Adam Benedict from the Pine Barrens Institute released his book Monsters in Print.
Mm-hmm.
And there's three stories in there from the turn of the 19th century from Canada and Alaska about people seeing mammoths.
Right.
And I'd never heard of that from North America at all, David. So when you were doing your research and pulling things together for Alaska, were you surprised by some of the creatures that have come forward, or were you aware of most of the things you'd covered?
No, pretty much all of them I was aware of to some degree or other. I had seen those mammoth stories years ago from early newspapers, and you know, I knew there were stories. There's been legends a long time, primarily out of Siberia, mm-hmm. parts of Canada, and a few stories from Alaska that mammoths. You know, some people were trying to imply, oh, they're probably still living there. I would love to think that, but you know, unfortunately, I think that at the least, what we might be looking at is probably a species that maybe survived a bit longer than is commonly accepted. Mm. And it is, at the very least, a very intriguing topic to explore. And you know, I was happy to do a section on that in the new book.
Mm. I mean, it wouldn't be a massive leap of faith to suspect some kind of pygmy mammoth primarily
right.
existing still up there, David, because those areas are so remote, they don't really lend themselves to archaeology. So it wouldn't surprise me that we've never stumbled across them, because obviously the mammoths we do know have been found all around the world.
Right, exactly. And, you know, people often don't realize, don't have a visual concept of how large Alaska is. Mm. I mean, it's a massive piece of land. And when you take in all the islands that are also part of Alaska, you're talking about an awful lot of territory.
Yes, and not a lot of people.
And not a lot of people. Yeah, a lot of it's just not, you know, not hospitable to many people, I guess, you know, although a lot of First Nations tribes that range across different parts of Alaska, and mm-hmm. they have found ways to survive through the years. But yeah, still vast amounts of unexplored land.
Yeah. So finally then, just before I let you leave, you mentioned Woodnox, the fourth volume. I believe Sam's done the cover for this one as well.
Yes, he has.
But he's also contributed, has he not?
He has. Yes, he's contributed a piece. And over the next couple of weeks, I'll start releasing some of the information. But we've got a great lineup again. Mm-hmm. Don't want to forget anybody, but I'll name a few people right top of my head. So we've got Chad Lewis, a good friend of mine who's from the Midwest, comes in with a piece on Wisconsin. Shannon LeGros, who hosts Into the Fray.
Yes.
She's on board this time. A lot of new contributors this time around. This is Sam's first time writing for the publication. Mm-hmm. And we've got, let's see, Jeff Stewart from Texas, mm-hmm. who has contributed before. He's back with another piece. Mm-hmm. Who else do we have? We have Thomas Curtin, who comes in. He's an Ohio researcher and has written a piece on the Grassman. Mm-hmm. We've got, who am I forgetting? Ulrich Magen from the Netherlands, who has come in with a piece. And he's written for 40 and Times and some other publications. And he's done a whole survey of wild man and Sasquatch in Europe, which is quite interesting. He's dug up some accounts that, you know, even I found, you know, unusual. I thought, well, I haven't, you know, there's one from Croatia, for instance, and just – areas that a lot of people haven't really dug into. So I think that's everyone. Myself, of course, I've got a long piece in there this time around.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I think we ended up seven contributors this time.
Fantastic. And that, once again, sort of later January or early
February? Yes. Yes.
Brilliant. Well, I wish you continued success, and I look forward to ordering both on Amazon. So, David, thank you for your time today. Where can everybody keep up to date with your work and obviously pre-order the books if required?
EerieLights.com. That is EerieLights.com. EerieLights.com. That has All the links you'll need are right there. There's news about upcoming releases. There's I put exclusive articles on there. There's links to other shows I've done. There's event listings. There's a contact form if somebody has a story about a creepy doll or a cryptid or anything else related to this field they want to shoot over to me, please do so. There's also, I'll throw this in there, I'm also pleased to announce that I am involved with a series that is coming out. It'll debut in the spring from Seth Breedlove.
Yep.
This one is On the Trail of UFOs. And there's a current trailer linked up on my website. You can check that out. Shannon is involved in that. She's the host, sort of traveling around, but they used me for a lot of commentary in the series, so I'll be featured in that also.
Oh, brilliant! I knew you were appearing in it, David. But I'm delighted to hear you've got a slightly larger part. I know Shannon, obviously, good friends, and always kept up to date with what she's up to, and obviously with Seth and everything. So I must admit, I was delighted as always when I see people I respect appear on their trailers, and you were one of them. So that's excellent news, David.
Yeah, well, thank you. Lots of other stuff coming next year. So check the website. It stays updated pretty frequently, and that's the best way to keep up with me.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for your time as always, sir. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for taking me down a very eerie trip in the world of haunted dolls. And we once again remind you, we try not to offend Robert, so apologies if he takes offence to what we said. That's not our intention at all.
That would be take offense at what you said. just a point of clarity there.
Yeah. Sorry
before
again.
Before you get to bed tonight.
Okay, yeah. On David's behalf, I say sorry from me, Paul, there, Robert, and thank you for that. So, David, thank you, and thank you for just reassuring my mind there for tonight's attempt to go to sleep. Been a pleasure as always. You take care. Have a great festive period, and all the best with the books in the new year.
Great talking with you, Paul. You have a great holiday season, and we'll talk again soon.